Disc 8.
Chapter 22.
Such a sweet letter from Lady Conway, Miss Knight said 2 days later as she deposited Miss Marple's breakfast tray. You remember my telling you about her? Just a little, you know, she tapped her forehead, wanders sometimes, and her memory's bad. Can't recognize her relations always and tells them to go away.
Well, that might be shrewdness, really, said Miss Marple, rather than loss of memory.
Now, now, said Miss Knight, aren't we being naughty to make suggestions like that? She's spending the winter at the Belgrave Hotel at Llandudno. Such a nice residential hotel. Splendid grounds, and a very nice glassed-in terrace. She's most anxious for me to come and join her there. She sighed.
Miss Marple sat herself upright in bed.
But please, she said, if you are wanted... If you are needed there, and would like to go... No, no, I couldn't hear of it, cried Miss Knight. Oh, no, I never meant anything like that. Why, what would Mr. Raymond West say? He explained to me that being here might turn out to be a permanency. I should never dream of not fulfilling my obligations. I was only just mentioning the fact in passing. So don't worry, dear, she added, patting Miss Marple on the shoulder. We're not going to be deserted. No, no, indeed we're not. We're going to be looked after and cosseted and made very happy and comfortable always.
She went out of the room.
Miss Marple sat with an air of determination, staring at her tray and failing to eat anything. Finally, she picked up the receiver of the telephone and dialed with vigour.
Dr. Haydock?
Yes?
Jane Marple here.
And what's the matter with you? In need of my professional services?
No, said Miss Marple, but I want to see you as soon as possible.
When Dr. Haydock came, he found Miss Marple still in bed waiting for him. You look the picture of health, he complained.
That is why I wanted to see you, said Miss Marple, to tell you that I am perfectly well.
An unusual reason for sending for the doctor. I'm quite strong, I'm quite fit, and it's absurd to have anybody living in the house. So long as someone comes every day and does the cleaning and all that, I don't see any need at all for having someone living here permanently.
I dare say you don't, but I do, said Dr. Haydock.
It seems to me... You're turning into a regular old fuss-budget, said Miss Marple unkindly.
And don't call me names, said Dr. Haydock. You're a very healthy woman for your age. You were pulled down a bit by bronchitis, which isn't good for the elderly, but to stay alone in a house at your age is a risk. Supposing you fall down the stairs one evening, or fall out of bed, or slip in the bath. There you'd lie and nobody'd know about it.
One can imagine anything, said Miss Marple.
Miss Knight might fall down the stairs, and I'd fall over her, rushing out to see what had happened.
It's no good your bullying me, said Dr. Haydock. You're an old lady, and you've got to be looked after in a proper manner. If you don't like this woman you've got, change her and get somebody else.
That's not always so easy, said Miss Marple.
Find some old servant of yours, someone that you like, and who's lived with you before. I can see this old hen irritates you. She'd irritate me. There must be some old servant somewhere. That nephew of yours is one of the best-selling authors of the day. He'd make it worth her while if you found the right person.
Of course, dear Raymond would do anything of that kind. He's most generous, said Miss Marple. But it's not so easy to find the right person. Young people have their own lives to live, and so many of my faithful old servants, I'm sorry to say, are dead.
Well, you're not dead, said Dr. Haydock, and you'll live a good deal longer if you take proper care of yourself.
He rose to his feet.
Well, he said, no good my stopping here. You look as fit as a fiddle. I shan't waste my time taking your blood pressure or feeling your pulse or asking your questions. You're thriving on all this local excitement. Even if you can't get about and poke your nose in as much as you'd like to. Goodbye. I've got to go now and do some real doctoring. 8 to 10 cases of German measles, 6 whooping coughs, and a suspected scarlet fever, as well as my regulars.
Dr. Haydock went out breezily, but Miss Marple was frowning. Something that he had said, what was it? Patients to see? The usual village ailments? Village ailments? Miss Marple pushed her breakfast tray farther away with a purposeful gesture. Then she rang up Mrs. Bantry. Dolly, Jane here, I want to ask you something. Now pay attention. Is it true that you told Inspector Craddock that Heather Batcock told Marina Gregg a long, pointless story about how she had chicken pox and got up in spite of it to go and meet Marina and get her autograph?
Well, that was it, more or less.
Chicken pox?
Well, something like that. Mrs. Alcock was talking to her about vodka at the time, so I wasn't really listening closely.
You're sure? Miss Marple took a breath. That she didn't say whooping cough.
Whooping cough? Mrs. Bantry sounded astounded. Of course not. She wouldn't have had to powder her face and do it up for whooping cough.
I see. That's what you went by, her special mention of makeup.
Well, she laid stress on it. She wasn't the making-up kind. But I think you're right. It wasn't chicken pox. Nettle rash, perhaps.
You only say that, said Miss Marple coldly, because you once had nettle rash yourself and couldn't go to a wedding. You're hopeless, Dolly, quite hopeless.
She put the receiver down with a bang, cutting off Mrs. Bantry's astonished protest of, "Really, Jane?" Miss Marple made a ladylike noise of vexation, like a cat sneezing, to indicate profound disgust. Her mind reverted to the problem of her own domestic comfort. Faithful Florence? Could faithful Florence, that grenadier of a former parlour-maid, be persuaded to leave her comfortable small house and come back to St. Mary Mead to look after her erstwhile mistress? Faithful Florence had always been very devoted to her, but faithful Florence was very attached to her own little house. Miss Marple shook her head vexedly. A gay rat-a-tat sounded at the door. On Miss Marple's calling, "Come in," Cherry entered. "I've come for your tray," she said. "Has anything happened? You're looking rather upset, aren't you?"
"I feel so helpless," said Miss Marple. "Old and helpless."
"Don't worry," said Cherry, picking up the tray. "You're very far from helpless. You don't know the things I hear about you in this place. Why, practically everybody in the development knows about you now. All sorts of extraordinary things you've done. They don't think of you as the old and helpless kind. It's she puts it into your head."
"She?"
Cherry gave a vigorous nod of her head backwards towards the door behind her. "Pussy, pussy," she said. "You're Miss Knight. Don't you let her get you down."
"She's very kind," said Miss Marple. "Really very kind," she added, in the tone of one who convinces herself.
"Gare killed the cat, they say," said Cherry. "You don't want kindness rubbed into your skin, so to speak, do you?"
"Oh, well," said Miss Marple, sighing. "I suppose we all have our troubles."
"I should say we do," said Cherry. "I oughtn't to complain, but I feel sometimes that if I live next door to Mrs. Hartwell any longer, there's going to be a regrettable incident. Sour-faced old cat, always gossiping and complaining. Jim's pretty fed up, too. He had a first-class row with her last night, just because we had the Messiah on a bit loud. You can't object to the Messiah, can you? I mean, it's religious.
Did she object?
She created something terrible, said Cherry. Banged on the wall and shouted and one thing and another.
Do you have to have your music turned on so loud? Asked Miss Marple.
Jim likes it that way, said Cherry. He says you don't get the tone unless you have full volume.
It might, suggested Miss Marple, be a little trying for anyone if they weren't musical.
It's these houses being semi-detached, said Cherry. Thin as anything, the walls. I'm not so keen, really, on all this new building when you come to think of it. It all looks very prissy and nice, but you can't express your personality without somebody being down on you like a ton of bricks.
Miss Marple smiled at her. You've got a lot of personality to express, Cherry, she said.
Do you think so?
Cherry was pleased, and she laughed.
I wonder, she began. Suddenly she looked embarrassed. She put down the tray and came back to the bed. I wonder if you'd think it cheek if I asked you something. I mean, you've only got to say out of the question, and that's that.
Something you want me to do?
Not quite. It's those rooms over the kitchen. They're never used nowadays, are they?
No.
Used to be a gardener and wife there once, so I heard. But that's old stuff. I wondered... What Jim and I wondered is if we could have them. Come and live here, I mean.
Miss Marple stared at her in astonishment. But your beautiful new house in the development.
We're both fed up with it. We like gadgets, but you can have gadgets anywhere. Get them on HB. And there would be a nice lot of room here, especially if Jim could have the room over the stables. He'd fix it up like new, and he could have all his construction models there, and wouldn't have to clear them away all the time. And if we had our stereogram there too, you'd hardly hear it.
Are you really serious about this, Jerry?
Yes, I am. Jim and I, we've talked about it a lot. Jim could fix things for you any time, you know, plumbing or a bit of carpentry. And I'd look after you every bit as well as your Miss Knight does. I know you think I'm a bit slapdash, but I'd try to take trouble with the beds and the washing up, and I'm getting quite a dab hand at cooking. Did beef stroganoff last night. It's quite easy, really.
Miss Marple contemplated her. Cherry was looking like an eager kitten. Vitality and joy of life radiated from her. Miss Marple thought once more of Faithful Florence. Faithful Florence would, of course, keep the house far better. Miss Marple put no faith in Cherry's promise. But she was at least 65, perhaps more. And would she really want to be uprooted? She might accept that out of very real devotion for Miss Marple, but did Miss Marple really want sacrifices made for her? Wasn't she already suffering from Miss Knight's conscientious devotion to duty? Cherry, however inadequate her housework, wanted to come. And she had qualities that to Miss Marple at this moment seemed of supreme importance. Warm-heartedness, vitality, and a deep interest in everything that was going on.
I don't want, of course, said Cherry, to go behind Miss Knight's back in any way.
Never mind about Miss Knight, said Miss Marple, coming to a decision. She'll go off to someone called Lady Conway at a hotel in Llandudno and enjoy herself thoroughly. We'll have to settle a lot of details, Cherry, and I shall want to talk to your husband, but if you really think you'd be happy...
It'd suit us down to the ground, said Cherry, and you really can rely on me doing things properly. I'll even use the dustpan and brush if you like.
Miss Marple laughed at this supreme offer.
Cherry picked up the breakfast tray again. I must get cracking. I got here late this morning, hearing about poor Arthur Badcock.
Arthur Badcock? What happened to him?
Haven't you heard? He's up at the police station now, said Cherry. They asked him if he'd come and assist them with their inquiries, and you know what that always means.
When did this happen?
Demanded Miss Marple. This morning, said Cherry. I suppose, she added, that it got out about his once having been married to Marina Gregg.
What?
Miss Marple sat up again.
Arthur Badcock was once married to Marina Gregg?
Well, that's the story, said Cherry. Nobody had any idea of it. It was Mr. Upshaw put it about. He's been to the States once or twice on business for his firm, and so he knows a lot of gossip from over there. It was a long time ago, you know. Really, before she'd begun her career. They were only married a year or two, and then she won a film award, and of course he wasn't good enough for her then. So they had one of these easy American divorces, and he just faded out, as you might say. He's the fading-out kind, Arthur Badcock. He wouldn't make a fuss. He changed his name and came back to England. It's all ever so long ago. You wouldn't think anything like that mattered nowadays, would you? Still, there it is. It's enough for the police to go on, I suppose.
Oh, no, said Miss Marple. Oh, no! This mustn't happen. If I could only think what to do. Now, let me see.
She made a gesture to Cherry. Take the tray away, Cherry, and send Miss Knight up to me. I'm going to get up. Cherry obeyed. Miss Marple dressed herself with fingers that fumbled slightly. It irritated her when she found excitement of any kind affecting her. She was just hooking up her dress when Miss Knight entered.
"Did you want me?" Cherry said.
Miss Marple broke in incisively.
"Get Inch," she said.
"I beg your pardon," said Miss Knight, startled.
"Inch," said Miss Marple. "Get Inch. Telephone for him to come at once."
Oh, I see. You mean the taxi people. But his name's Roberts, isn't it?
To me, said Miss Marple, he is Inch, and always will be. But anyway, get him. He's to come here at once.
You want to go for a little drive?
Just get him, can you? Said Miss Marple. And hurry, please.
Miss Knight looked at her doubtfully, and proceeded to do as she was told.
"We are feeling all right, dear, aren't we?" she said anxiously. "We are both feeling very well," said Miss Marple, "and I am feeling particularly well. Inertia does not suit me, and never has. A practical course of action, that is what I have been wanting for a long time."
"Has that Mrs. Baker been saying something that has upset you?"
"Nothing has upset me," said Miss Marple. "I feel particularly well. I am annoyed with myself for being stupid. But really, until I got a hint from Dr. Haydock this morning, I wonder if I remember it rightly. Where is that medical book of mine?"
She gestured Miss Knight aside and walked firmly down the stairs. She found the book she wanted in a shelf in the drawing room. Taking it out, she looked up the index, murmured, "Page 210, turned to the page in question, read for a few moments, then nodded her head, satisfied.
"It's most remarkable," she said. "Most curious. I don't suppose anybody would ever have thought of it. I didn't myself until the two things came together, so to speak."
Then she shook her head, and a little line appeared between her eyes.
"If only there was someone."
She went over in her mind the various accounts she had been given of that particular scene. Her eyes widened in thought.
There was someone, but would he, she wondered, be any good? One never knew with the vicar. He was quite unpredictable.
Nevertheless, she went to the telephone and dialed.
"Good morning, Vicar. This is Miss Marple."
"Oh, yes, Miss Marple.
Anything I can do for you?
I wonder if you could help me on a small point. It concerns the day of the fete when poor Mrs. Badcock died. I believe you were standing quite near Miss Gregg when Mr. and Mrs. Badcock arrived.
Yes, I was just before them, I think. Such a tragic day.
Yes, indeed. And I believe that Mrs. Badcock was recalling to Miss Gregg that they had met before in Bermuda. She had been ill in bed and had got up specially.
Yes. Yes, I do remember.
And do you remember if Mrs. Badcock mentioned the illness she was suffering from?
I think now. Let me see. Yes, it was measles. At least not real measles. German measles, a much less serious disease. Some people hardly feel ill at all with it. I remember my cousin Caroline. Miss Marple cut off reminiscences of Cousin Caroline by saying firmly, "Thank you so much, Vicar," and replacing the receiver. There was an awed expression on her face. One of the great mysteries of St. Mary Mead was what made the vicar remember certain things, only outstripped by the greater mystery of what the vicar could manage to forget. "A taxi's here, dear," said Miss Knight, bustling in. "It's a very old one, and not too clean, I should say. I don't really like your driving in a thing like that. You might pick up some germ or other."
"Nonsense," said Miss Marple. Setting her hat firmly on her head and buttoning up her summer coat, she went out to the waiting taxi.
"Good morning, Roberts," she said.
"Good morning, Miss Marple. You're early this morning. Where do you want to go?"
"Gossington Hall, please," said Miss Marple. "I'd better come with you, hadn't I, dear?" said Miss Knight. "It won't take a minute just to slip into outdoor shoes."
"No, thank you," said Miss Marple firmly. "I'm going by myself. Drive on, Roberts.
Mr. Roberts drove on, merely remarking, "Ah, Gossington Hall. Great changes there, and everywhere nowadays, all that development. Never thought anything like that had come to St. Mary Mead." Upon arrival at Gossington Hall, Miss Marple rang the bell and asked to see Mr. Jason Rudd. Giuseppe's successor, a rather shaky-looking elderly man, conveyed doubt. "Mr. Rudd," he said, "does not see anybody without an appointment, madam, and today especially."
"I have no appointment," said Miss Marple, "but I will wait," she added.
She stepped briskly past him into the hall and sat down on a hall chair.
"I am afraid it will be quite impossible this morning, madam." "In that case," said Miss Marple, "I shall wait until this afternoon."
Baffled, the new butler retired. Presently a young man came to Miss Marple. He had a pleasant manner and a cheerful, slightly American voice.
"I've seen you before," said Miss Marple. "In the development. You asked me the way to Blenheim Close."
Hayley Preston smiled good-naturedly. "I guess you did your best, but you misdirected me badly."
"Dear me, did I?" said Miss Marple. "So many closes, aren't there? Can I see Mr. Rudd?"
"Why, now, that's too bad," said Hayley Preston. "Mr. Rudd's a busy man, and he's, fully occupied this morning, and really can't be disturbed."
"I'm sure he's very busy," said Miss Marple. "I came here quite prepared to wait."
"Why, I'd suggest now," said Hayley Preston, "that you should tell me what it is you want. I deal with all these things for Mr. Rudd, you see. Everyone has to see me first."
"I'm afraid," said Miss Marple, "that I want to see Mr. Rudd himself. And," she added, "I shall wait here until I do."
She settled herself more firmly in the large oak chair.
Haley Preston hesitated, started to speak, finally turned away and went upstairs. He returned with a large man in tweeds. "This is Dr. Gilchrist, Miss
Marple."
"So, you're Miss Marple," said Dr. Gilchrist.
He looked at her with a good deal of interest. Haley Preston slipped away with celerity.
"I've heard about you," said Dr. Gilchrist, "from Dr. Haydock."
"Dr. Haydock is a very old friend of mine."
"He certainly is. Now, you want to see Mr. Jason Rudd?"
"Why?"
"It is necessary that I should," said Miss Marple.
Dr. Gilchrist's eyes appraised her.
"And you're camping here until you do?" he asked.
"Exactly."
"You would, too," said Dr. Gilchrist.
"In that case, I will give you a perfectly good reason why you cannot see Mr. Rudd. His wife died last night in her sleep."
"Dead?" exclaimed Miss Marple. "How?"
"An overdose of sleeping stuff. We don't want the news to leak out to the press for a few hours, so I'll ask you to keep this knowledge to yourself for the moment."
"Of course. Was it an accident?"
"Well, that is definitely my view," said Gilchrist.
"But it could be suicide."
"It could, but most unlikely."
"Or someone could have given it to her?"
Gilchrist shrugged his shoulders. "A most remote contingency, and a thing," he added firmly, "that would be quite impossible to prove."
"I see," said Miss Marple.
She took a deep breath.
"I'm sorry, but it's more necessary than ever that I should see Mr. Rudd."
Gilchrist looked at her. "Wait here," he said. Chapter 23. Jason Rudd looked up as Gilchrist entered.
"There's an old dame downstairs," said the doctor. "Looks about 100. Wants to see you. Won't take no, and says she'll wait. She'll wait till this afternoon, I gather, or she'll wait till this evening. And she's quite capable, I should say, of spending the night here. She's got something she badly wants to say to you. I'd see her if I were you."
Jason Rudd looked up from his desk. His face was white and strained.
"Is she mad?"
"No, not in the least."
"I don't see why I..." "Oh, all right. Send her up. What does it matter?"
Gilchrist nodded, went out of the room, and called to Haley Preston.
"Mr. Rudd can spare you a few minutes now, Miss Marple," said Haley Preston, appearing again by her side.
"Thank you. That's very kind of him," said Miss Marple as she rose to her feet. "Have you been with Mr. Rudd long?" she asked.
"Why, I've worked with Mr. Rudd for the last 2.5 years. My job is public relations, generally."
"I see."
Miss Marple looked at him thoughtfully.
"You remind me very much," she said, "of someone I knew called Gerald French."
"Indeed? What did Gerald French do?"
"Not very much," said Miss Marple. "But he was a very good talker," she sighed. "He had had an unfortunate past."
"You don't say," said Haley Preston, slightly ill at ease. "What kind of a past?"
"I won't repeat it," said Miss Marple. "He didn't like it talked about."
Jason Rudd rose from his desk and looked with some surprise at the slender elderly lady who was advancing towards him.
"You wanted to see me?" he said. "What can I do for you?"
"I am very sorry about your wife's death," said Miss Marple. "I can see it has been a great grief to you, and I want you to believe that I should not intrude upon you now or offer you sympathy unless it was absolutely necessary. But there are things that need badly to be cleared up unless an innocent man is going to suffer."
"An innocent man? I don't understand you."
"Arthur Badcock," said Miss Marple. "He is with the police now, being questioned."
"Questioned in connection with my wife's death? But that's absurd. Absolutely absurd. He's never been near the place. He didn't even know her."
"I think he knew her," said Miss Marple. "He was married to her once."
"Arthur Badcock? But he was Heather Badcock's husband. Aren't you perhaps..." He spoke kindly and apologetically. "Making a little mistake?"
"He was married to both of them," said Miss Marple. "He was married to your wife when she was very young, before she went into pictures."
Jason Rudd shook his head. "My wife was first married to a man called Alfred Beadle. He was in real estate. They were not suited, and they parted almost immediately."
"Then Alfred Beadle changed his name to Badcock," said Miss Marple. "He's in a real estate firm here. It's odd how some people never seem to like to change their job and want to go on doing the same thing. I expect, really, that's why Marina Gregg felt that he was no use to her. He couldn't have kept up with her."
"Well, what you've told me is most surprising."
"I can assure you that I am not romancing or imagining things. What I am telling you is sober fact. These things get round very quickly in a village, you know. Though they take a little longer," she added, "in reaching the hall."
"Well," Jason Rudd stalled, uncertain what to say. "Then he accepted the position." "And what do you want me to do for you, Miss Marple?" he asked.
"I want, if I may, to stand on the stairs at the spot where you and your wife received guests on the day of the fete."
He shot a quick, doubtful glance at her. Was this, after all, just another sensation-seeker? But Miss Marple's face was grave and composed. "Why, certainly," he said. "If you want to do so, come with me."
He led her to the staircase head and paused in the hollowed-out bay at the top of it. "You've made a good many changes in the house since the Bantrys were here," said Miss Marple. "I like this. Now, let me see. The tables would be about here, I suppose, and you and your wife would be standing..."
"My wife stood here." Jason showed her the place. "People came up the stairs. She shook hands with them and passed them on to me."
"She stood here," said Miss Marple.
She moved over and took her place where Marina Gregg had stood. She remained there quite quietly, without moving. Jason Rudd watched her. He was perplexed, but interested. She raised her right hand slightly, as though shaking it. Looked down the stairs, as though to see people coming up. Then she looked straight ahead of her. On the wall, halfway up the stairs, was a large picture. A copy of an Italian old master. On either side of it were narrow windows, one giving out on the garden, and the other giving on to the end of the stables and the weathercock. But Miss Marple looked at neither of these. Her eyes were fixed on the picture itself.
"Of course, you always hear a thing right the first time," she said. "Mrs. Bantry told me
that your wife stared at the picture, and her face froze, as she put it. She looked at the rich red and blue robes of the Madonna, a Madonna with her head slightly back, laughing up at the Holy Child that she was holding up in her arms. "Giacomo Bellini's Laughing Madonna," she said. "A religious picture, but also a painting of a happy mother with her child. Isn't that so, Mr. Rudd?"
"I would say so, yes."
"I understand now," said Miss Marple. "I understand quite well. The whole thing is really very simple, isn't it?" She looked at Jason Rudd.
"Simple?"
"I think you know how simple it is," said Miss Marple. There was a peal on the bell below.
"I don't think," said Jason Rudd, "I quite understand."
He looked down the stairway. There was a sound of voices. "I know that voice," said Miss Marple. "It's Inspector Craddock's voice, isn't it?"
"Yes, it seems to be Inspector Craddock."
"He wants to see you too. Would you mind very much if he joined us?"
"Not at all, as far as I'm concerned. Whether he will agree..."
"I think he will agree," said Miss Marple. "There's really not much time now to be lost, is there? We've got to the moment when we've got to understand just how everything happened."
"I thought you said it was simple," said Jason Rudd.
"It was so simple," said Miss Marple, "that one just couldn't see it."
The decayed butler arrived at this moment up the stairs. "Inspector Craddock is here, sir," he said. "Ask him to join us here, please," said Jason Rudd.
The butler disappeared again, and a moment or two later Dermot Craddock came up the stairs.
"You!" he said to Miss Marple. "How did you get here?"
"I came an inch," said Miss Marple, producing the usual confused effect that that remark always caused. From slightly behind her, Jason Rudd rapped his forehead interrogatively. Dermot Craddock shook his head.
"I was saying to Mr. Rudd," said Miss Marple, "has the butler gone away?"
Dermot Craddock cast a look down the stairs.
"Oh, yes," he said. "He's not listening. Sergeant Tiddler will see to that."
"Then that is all right," said Miss Marple. "We could, of course, have gone into a room to talk, but I prefer it like this. Here we are on the spot where the thing happened, which makes it so much easier to understand."
"You are talking," said Jason Rudd, "of the day of the fate here, the day when Heather Badcock was poisoned?"
"Yes," said Miss Marple. "And I'm saying that it is all very simple if one only looks at it in the proper way. It all began, you see, with Heather Badcock being the kind of person she was. It was inevitable, really, that something of that kind should happen some day to Heather."
"I don't understand what you mean," said Jason Rudd. "I don't understand at all."
"No, it has to be explained a little. You see, when my friend Mrs. Bantry, who was here, described the scene to me, she quoted a poem that was a great favourite in my youth, a poem of dear Lord Tennyson's, The Lady of Shalott." She raised her voice a little. "The mirror cracked from side to side. 'The curse is come upon me,' cried the Lady of Shalott." That's what Mrs. Bantry saw. Or thought she saw, though actually she misquoted and said doom instead of curse, perhaps a better word in the circumstances. She saw your wife speaking to Heather Badcock, and heard Heather Badcock speaking to your wife. And she saw this look of doom on your wife's face.
"Haven't we been over that a great many times?" said Jason Rudd.
Yes, but we shall have to go over it once more, said Miss Marple. There was that expression on your wife's face, and she was not looking at Heather Badcock, but at that picture. At a picture of a laughing, happy mother holding up a happy child. The mistake was that though there was doom foreshadowed in Marina Gregg's face, it was not on her the doom would come. The doom was to come upon Heather. Heather was doomed from the first moment she began talking and boasting of an incident in the past.
"Could you make yourself a little clearer?" said Dermot Craddock. Miss Marple turned to him.
"Of course I will. This is something that you know nothing about. You couldn't know about it, because nobody has told you what it was Heather Badcock actually said."
"But they have," protested Dermot. "They've told me over and over again. Several people have told me."
"Yes," said Miss Marple, "but you don't know because, you see, Heather Badcock didn't tell it to you."
"She hardly could tell it to me, seeing she was dead when I arrived here," said Dermot.
"Quite so," said Miss Marple. "All you know is that she was ill, but she got up from bed and came along to a celebration of some kind, where she met Marina Gregg, and spoke to her, and asked for an autograph, and was given one."
"I know," said Craddock with slight impatience. "I've heard all that."
"But you didn't hear the one operative phrase, because no one thought it was important," said Miss Marple. "Heather Badcock was ill in bed with German measles."
"German measles? What on earth has that got to do with it?"
"It's a very slight illness, really," said Miss Marple. "It hardly makes you feel ill at all. You have a rash, which is easy to cover up with powder, and you have a little fever, but not very much. You feel quite well enough to go out and see people if you want to. And, of course, in repeating all this, the fact that it was German measles didn't strike people particularly. Mrs. Bantry, for instance, just said that Heather had been ill in bed and mentioned chicken pox and nettle rash. Mr. Rudd here said that it was flu. But, of course, he did that on purpose. But I think myself that what Heather Badcock said to Marina Gregg was that she had had German measles and got up from bed and went off to meet Marina. And that's really the answer to the whole thing, because, you see, German measles is extremely infectious. People catch it very easily. And there's one thing about it which you've got to remember. If a woman contracts it in the first 4 months of..." Miss Marple spoke the next word with a slight Victorian modesty, "of the pregnancy, it may have a terribly serious effect. It may cause an unborn child to be born blind, or to be born mentally affected." She turned to Jason Rudd. "I think I am correct in saying, Mr. Rudd, that your wife had a child who was born mentally afflicted, and that she has never really recovered from the shock. She had always wanted a child, and when at last the child came, this was the tragedy that happened, a tragedy she has never forgotten, that she has not allowed herself to forget, and which ate into her as a kind of deep sore, an obsession."
"It's quite true," said Jason Rudd. "Marina developed German measles early on in her pregnancy, and was told by the doctor that the mental affliction of her child was due to that cause. It was not a case of inherited insanity
or anything of that kind. He was trying to be helpful, but I don't think it helped her much. She never knew how, or when, or from whom she had contracted the disease.
Quite so, said Miss Marple. She never knew until one afternoon here, when a perfectly strange woman came up those stairs and told her the fact. Told her, what was more, with a great deal of pleasure, with an air of being proud of what she'd done. She thought she'd been resourceful and brave, and shown a lot of spirit in getting up from her bed, covering her face with makeup, and going along to meet the actress on whom she had such a crush, and obtaining her autograph. It's a thing she has boasted of all through her life. Heather Badcock meant no harm. She never did mean harm. But there is no doubt that people like Heather Badcock, and like my old friend Alison Wilde, are capable of doing a lot of harm because they lack, not kindness, they have kindness, but any real consideration for the way their actions may affect other people. She thought always of what an action meant to her, never sparing a thought to what it might mean to somebody else. Miss Marple nodded her head gently. So she died, you see, for a simple reason out of her own past. You must imagine what that moment meant to Marina Gregg. I think Mr. Rudd understands it very well. I think she had nursed all those years a kind of hatred for the unknown person who had been the cause of her tragedy. And here she suddenly meets that person face to face. And a person who is gay, jolly, and pleased with herself. It was too much for her. If she had had time to think, to calm down, to be persuaded, to relax, but she gave herself no time. Here was this woman who had destroyed her happiness and destroyed the sanity and health of her child. She wanted to punish her. She wanted to kill her. And, unfortunately, the means were to hand. She carried with her that well-known specific, Calmo. A somewhat dangerous drug because you had to be careful of the exact dosage. It was very easy to do. She put the stuff into her own glass. If by any chance anyone noticed what she was doing, they were probably so used to her pepping herself up or soothing herself down in any handy liquid that they'd hardly notice it. It's possible that one person did see her, but I rather doubt it. I think that Miss Zielinski did no more than guess. Marina Gregg put her glass down on the table, and presently she managed to jog Heather Badcock's arm, so that Heather Badcock spilt her own drink all down her new dress. And that's where the element of puzzle has come into the matter, owing to the fact that people cannot remember to use their pronouns properly. It reminds me so much of that parlour-maid I was telling you about, she added to Dermot. I only had the account, you see, of what Gladys Dixon said to Cherry, which simply was that she was worried about the ruin of Heather Badcock's dress with the cocktails spilt down it. What seemed so funny, she said, was that she did it on purpose. But the she that Gladys referred to was not Heather Badcock. It was Marina Gregg. As Gladys said, she did it on purpose. She jogged Heather's arm. Not by accident, but because she meant to do so. We do know that she must have been standing very close to Heather, because we have heard that she mopped up both Heather's dress and her own before pressing her cocktail on Heather. It was really, said Miss Marple meditatively, a very perfect murder, Because, you see, it was committed on the spur of the moment without pausing to think or reflect. She wanted Heather Badcock dead, and a few minutes later, Heather Badcock was dead. She didn't realize, perhaps, the seriousness of what she'd done, and certainly not the danger of it, until afterwards. But she realized it then. She was afraid, horribly afraid. Afraid that someone had seen her dope her own glass, that someone had seen her deliberately jog Heather's elbow. Afraid that someone would accuse her of having poisoned Heather. She could see only one way out. To insist that the murder had been aimed at her, that she was the prospective victim. She tried that idea first on her doctor. She refused to let him tell her husband, because I think she knew that her husband would not be deceived. She did fantastic things. She wrote notes to herself and arranged to find them in extraordinary places and at extraordinary moments. She doctored her own coffee at the studios one day. She did things that could really have been seen through fairly easily if one had happened to be thinking that way. They were seen through by one person. She looked at Jason Rudd.
"Well, this is only a theory of yours," said Jason Rudd.
"You can put it that way if you like," said Miss Marple. "But you know quite well, don't you, Mr. Rudd, that I'm speaking the truth. You know because you knew from the first. You knew because you heard that mention of German measles. You knew and you were frantic to protect her. But you didn't realize how much you would have to protect her from. You didn't realize that it was not only a question of hushing up one death, the death of a woman whom you might quite fairly say had brought her death upon herself. But there were other deaths. The death of Giuseppe, a blackmailer, it is true, but a human being. And the death of Ella Zielinski, of whom I expect you were fond. You were frantic to protect Marina, and also to prevent her from doing more harm. All you wanted was to get her safely away somewhere. You tried to watch her all the time, to make sure that nothing more should happen." She paused, and then coming nearer to Jason Rudd, she laid a gentle hand on his arm. "I am very sorry for you," she said. "Very sorry. I do realize the agony that you've been through. You cared for her so much, didn't you?"
Jason Rudd turned slightly away. "That," he said, "is, I believe, common knowledge."
"She was such a beautiful creature," said Miss Marple gently. "She had such a wonderful gift. She had a great power of love and hate, but no stability. That's what's so sad for anyone, to be born with no stability. She couldn't let the past go, and she could never see the future as it really was, only as she imagined it to be. She was a great actress, and a beautiful and very unhappy woman. What a wonderful Mary Queen of Scots she was! I shall never forget her."
Sergeant Tiddler appeared suddenly on the stairs. "Sir," he said, "can I speak to you a moment?"
Craddock turned.
"I'll be back," he said to Jason Rudd. Then he went towards the stairs.
"Remember," Miss Marple called after him, "poor Arthur Badcock had nothing to do with this. He came to the fete because he wanted to have a glimpse of the girl he had married long ago. I should say she didn't even recognize him. Did she?
She asked Jason Rudd. Jason Rudd shook his head. I don't think so. She certainly never said anything to me. I don't think, he added thoughtfully, she would recognize him.
Probably not, said Miss Marple. Anyway, she added, he's quite innocent of wanting to kill her or anything of that kind. Remember that,
she added to Dermot Craddock as he went down the stairs. He's not been in any real danger, I can assure you, said Craddock. But, of course, when we found out that he had actually been Miss Marina Gregg's first husband, we naturally had to question him on the point. Don't worry about him, Aunt Jane, he added in a low murmur. Then he hurried down the stairs. Miss Marple turned to Jason Rudd. He was standing there, like a man in a daze, his eyes far away.
Would you allow me to see her?
Said Miss Marple. He considered her for a moment or two, then he nodded. Yes, you can see her. You seem to understand her very well. He turned, and Miss Marple followed him. He preceded her into the big bedroom and drew the curtain slightly aside. Marina Gregg lay in the great white shell of the bed, her eyes closed, her hands folded. So, Miss Marple thought, might the Lady of Shalott have lain in the boat that carried her down to Camelot. And there, standing musing, was a man with a rugged, ugly face, who might pass as a Lancelot of a later day. Miss Marple said gently,
It's very fortunate for her that she took an overdose. Death was really the only way of escape left to her. Yes, very fortunate she took that overdose, or was given it.
His eyes met hers, but he did not speak. He said brokenly,
She was so lovely, and she had suffered so much.
Miss Marple looked back again at the still figure. She quoted softly the last lines of the poem. He said, She has a lovely face. God in his mercy lend her grace, the Lady of Shalott.